You have 2 hours, 3 minutes remaining for this call.
All right, what you're hearing is me. Hello?
Mark.
What you're hearing is me trying to call Germany, because I got an editor from Journal of Aesthetics and Protests. He's just been to the Glasgow summit and has a bunch of stuff that he wants to talk about, a bunch of social justice projects that he wants to talk about, but he's asleep because it's 4 o'clock in the morning there. So I just talked to him, I just emailed him at 1 o'clock this afternoon. My time, and he said it was 1 o'clock in the morning. So I'm going to try and get a hold of him, but if not, I've also just found a gong with Bill Bruford from 1974 in Oslo, Norway. So if I can't get a hold of Mark, I'll play you the Oslo, Norway thing. And you can support us here at KEPW on by going to kepw.org. We're looking for it's Pledge Week, so that would be good if you can help us. All right, so I'm doing like 6 different things at once here, and either it's going to be Bill Bruford with gong, a rare gong, or Mark from Journal of Aesthetics and Protest. If not, I'm going to try to get him early in the morning on a Saturday morning and record it. I'm testing my station recording studio right now. So let's try this again.
This card is already in use. Goodbye. You have $48.40 remaining. Please enter the telephone number you wish to dial now. Please enter the telephone number you wish to dial now. Please enter the telephone number you wish to dial now. That is an invalid telephone number. Please enter the telephone number you wish to dial now. The speed dial code. You have $48.40 remaining. Please enter the telephone number you wish to dial now. You have 2 hours, 1 minute remaining for this call. Your call cannot be completed now. Please try your call again in a few minutes. Thank you for your patience. You have $48.40 remaining. Please enter the telephone number.
All right, as you can hear, I'm having a little troubles. It's not that the call won't go through. It's that he's asleep because it's 4 o'clock in the morning in Germany, so it might not happen. But we'll see. Maybe he'll wake up. Been scheduling it for a week. But like I say, it's not his fault. I was appreciative that he would do it at 4 o'clock in the morning. So, And I'm testing our computer right now to see if I'll be able to record a phone call without recording on our broadcast computer. Just to let you in on our technical abilities here at KPW. And we can use your money. We could use some funding here. Go to kepw.org and send us some money. Let's see. Maybe he answered the phone, and I didn't, and that's why it wasn't working.
You have $48.40 remaining. Please enter the telephone number you wish to dial now.
Come on, Mark.
You have 2 hours, 1 minute remaining for this call.
Come on, baby.
Hello?
Hey, Mark. It's Curtis with KPW.
Hey, Curtis.
Right on. I'm sorry. So I really appreciate you getting up at 4 o'clock in the freaking morning to do this interview.
It's 4 o'clock. It's only 1.
Oh, it's only 1. Okay, well, that's party time. That's when the party starts.
Exactly.
Yeah, so how's the weather there in Germany?
It was a little chilly today, but it was beautifully sunny. And I was working outside, so that was very nice.
All right, so what exactly is the Journal of Aesthetics and Protest?
It is a weirdo archive, a collection of thoughts and oddities, and also very straightforward political theory and aesthetic theory, and a way of looking at the world that has to do with avant-garde perceptions of possibility.
All right, and so you're the editor there. What are your duties there?
I'm a co-editor and co-publisher. We have been publishing for 20 years. And it's my understanding that thought is much better collaboratively. And so as a co-editor, I work with people to help develop thought in practice.
All right. And so you just came back from Glasgow, where you're promoting a book, right?
Yes. I just came back from Glasgow for the book launch of We Are Nature Defending Itself, by Isabel Fremeau and Jay Jordan, that I've been editing for 5 years, with that we released with the Vagabonds imprint of Pluto Press. I'm holding the book in my hand, and it is a lovely book that's a little larger than a normal pocket-sized book, with a tarot card on the third page. This series of books has a specially designed tarot card for each of the issues in the series, and this book is about entanglement, art, and activism in the autonomous zone of the Zod.
Are you there?
Yes, okay. I am.
All right, the Zad, yeah. So do you want to talk about the Zad? That's an example of kind of a culture jam that they're advocating. Isn't that what their book is about? Is kind of we used to call it culture jamming, but it's what would you call what the book is about? Nature defending itself.
I think to disagree with you, not for any sake of disagreement, but I wouldn't call it culture jamming. Culture jamming suggests that you're engaging with mainstream media in order to play with it or screw with it. But what they did on the Zod was literally The Zad is a place near Brittany, or in the state of Brittany in France, near the city of Nantes, where 50 years ago the French state proposed an airport to be built. And the local farmers decided, we don't want that. And they have been organizing since around 16, been told, where there were people from within non-union organizers and farmers were doing a lot of collaborations, and the local farmers there developed a strategy of resistance to the state upon collaboration with local union organizers, if I remember the story correctly. And so they did a low-level resistance for many years. The French state, because the planned airport didn't enforce upon agricultural modernization, okay. And so the unique landscape that was preserved over time.
All right, you're breaking up. And can you stay in one place or move to a window or something?
Yeah.
All right.
I'm right by a window. My head was away from the phone. I will try and speak
there,
a little more. That's directly into the phone.
Yeah, that's better. All right, so I'm sorry, continue.
And so what happened, and no problem. And so what happened was that in the UK, around 2004 to 2010, there was a strong movement known as the Climate Camp Movement, where green activists would do prefigurative protests, a week-long encampment at places that capital and the state destroy. At the time, and they occupied Heathrow Airport, there's a strange feedback, which is why I'm having problems speaking to the phone.
Yeah, it's cutting in and out. I can barely make sense of what you're saying. So, what is the background noise? What is that background noise? Is that from the room that you're in, or...?
My room is silent, so okay. I could say.
All right, so there's some interference in the line. But the interference isn't the problem. It's the breaking up.
So. Okay. Shall I continue, or should we just...
Whatever you're doing right now, it was working perfectly. So, yeah, continue.
Okay. Yeah, the feedback has stopped. So the climate camps were a movement in the... from around 2004 till 2008, where British activists were creating a reality in a site of protest. They were occupying power stations and airports around ecological issues and the entanglement with capitalism. And they were winning battles. What happened around 2008 was the economic crisis in Europe, and they decided that what they needed to fight capitalism and its extractive nature was to engage more directly with debt struggles in the UK. And so a few activists of mine and others also began expanding the climate camp movement into continental Europe. And through that, the people near Nantes, who'd been resisting an airport, invited the climate camp to begin to occupy the airport, the farmland that the French state had wanted to turn into an airport. And so, about 300 houses were occupied over the course of 5 years, because the state had been clearing farmhouses in this small village, there were these abandoned houses where people were invited to occupy. And so far more than culture jamming, this became a place where activists from mostly UK and France began to call home. And the French state, at that point, was pushing up and ramping up their desire to turn this space into an airport. Now, some of the organizers, Some of them related to the Tikkun Collective. Some of them related to the Climate Camp movement, and the co-authors of my book, Isabel Frameau and Jay Jordan, who were key organizers in Reclaim the Streets, were quite effective in organizing resistance in solidarity with the local farmers. And so they were able to call around 40,000 people in initial struggle to defend this place when the French state moved in to decide to clear it out. So when you have 40,000 people in forests battling cops in a diversity of tactics, the police had to back down. And so what was established, I think between 2013 and 2018, was a place where the French state, where police and courts were not operative. They basically turned it into an autonomous zone with the strategy that's thinking that the activists would eat themselves alive. Instead, they created a complex culture of self-management with a variety of individuals and collectives, from organic farmers and farmers using mixed techniques, to vegans, to people who were against industrial agriculture, to nonviolent tactics people, to people who were insurrectionists, and kind of every mix, living together in this small town where the police and the judges were not entering. And so I was asked to edit a book, the author, in 2015, as a call to English-speaking activists to help them defend this territory. And what happened over time is the authors would occasionally pop in and say, oh, we need to hold off the text because everything has changed, the battle has changed, let's not put this book out yet. And it became clear that over the course of these 5 years, we were actually going to win. That they had managed to take out the French state, they had managed to stop the completion of the airport, they had managed ultimately to win squatters' rights, their houses and farms, and had created what many people see as a possible base for post-capitalist ways of relating and entangling life in opposition to, as they call it, the airport and its world.
Right, and so the success of this, is the sheer numbers of people and the publicity that it got drew a large number of people for support. And then, so this is an example, though, of why we need to stop capitalism from taking over, from stopping people from doing alternative lifestyles, because here's an alternative lifestyle that is done in the commons. And so this is why we need to preserve the commons for people that want to experiment with an alternative lifestyle that looks like it might be a very good lifestyle.
I have a different spin on that. Okay. I see that the commons exist regardless. Right now, you and I are having a commons of a conversation. We've established that by you calling me and us engaging in a conversation. And as this conversation continues, we are enriching this commons. And one could talk about the commons of capitalist exchange, the territory upon which there is free play between money and moneyed interest. I don't see the commons as something that is, philosophically speaking, preserved or unpreserved. The commons exists as a place for exchange and play. But what people did, rather than preserve the commons, was to establish a particular right to a common way of relating in a common place. And that enriched environment that allowed for a variety of people to live their lives individually, but also in common and in exchange, and by defending the territory of their commons that they had established, the culture that they had established, and the rituals and the practices that they had established, by falling in love with the commons that they had established together, in collaboration with the animals, the nature, and the wider community that was in solidarity and support and in common with them, made a beast that was impossible for the state to tackle.
Right. Well, so we're working within the cycles of the commons rather than extracting in a linear and dealing with the commons in a linear way. Instead of having dominion over the over nature, we're have a kind of a stewardship and a symbiotic relationship with nature.
Yes, that's probably that's a wonderful way of putting it.
All right, so. Go ahead.
And so one thing that I'm quite interested in this book that the author wrote about is some of the ritual aspects that they utilized to highlight the continuity of their time and the ritualistic nature rather than the linear nature of what it is to be together. And to returning to issues and conflicts that they had among themselves over time, knowing that there are some conflicts that couldn't be worked out in a linear fashion but needed to be attended to and nurtured. So I very much agree with your idea of the commons as either a linear commons or an extractivist commons, which is pulling value out, or a circular commons, which is attending to the circular nature of a place and its routines and its practices and its habits that can only be solved with engagement over time rather than against time and towards profit.
All right, and so I see this as more of a direct action rather than a protest. And for, like the example, in our email I said that protest seems to be futile. And what I meant was that, for instance, this George Floyd thing that happened, you know, it took an entire world protest to get this guy convicted, the policeman convicted, and he almost was acquitted, and it took a worldwide protest. Do we need to take direct action, do you think, and isn't that what nature defending itself? Do we need to actively defend nature rather than just protest? Is it time to take direct action?
Yes, I agree with you. But I also, one thing that the authors are very clear about in this book is that there's a variety of tactics that are important in any struggle. There are people who are capable of making direct action and putting themselves on the line and willing to risk arrest. And there's other forms of action that are equally important. Solidarity events around the world help support this action by people doing banner hangs in front of French embassies, in front of French banks and French companies to tell everyone who was involved both in the French state and the particular companies that were going to profit from this, that they are being watched. That people know what's going on, not only in France, not only in Brittany, not only in Nantes, not only in the small town of Notre-Dame-de-Lande, but people around the world are aware of this. And also, they are very much aware of how their wider network of solidarity facilitated this tiny struggle. And so, I published a journal called the Journal of Aesthetic Protest, and I've over time stepped away from organizing direct action and protest into things that I'm more interested and enriched by personally. But that doesn't mean that as an activist and as an artist and a writer and an organizer, I don't value the role of protest, which has a part in the ecology of making a better world. We're going to call protest hanging out with a sign and screaming, there are times when that's necessary and places where it's quite useful.
Well, yeah, it seemed to work in the George Floyd case. It seemed that it actually finally worked. I was skeptical myself that it was going to work. All right, so I'm talking to Mark from the Journal of Aesthetics and Protest here on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. All right, so there's stuff that you wanted to, there's projects that you're working on that you want to talk about. You want to get into those? Like, you sent me the climate care, you had a climate care summit last September. Do you want to talk about that?
I'm trying to remember. I think it might be interesting first to talk about the experiences in the Glasgow COP summit recently, just to stay on topic.
Oh, yeah, by all means. Yeah, please. Yeah, I'd like to hear about that.
Yeah, it was quite interesting to be there and to get a sense of where we are in a global question around global governance, around our rapidly decaying environment. I went to the Paris Climate Summit in 2015 as a protester, and it was interesting. The direct action forms that were being engaged in were rather familiar to culturally to what had been kind of standard anti-globalization, alter-globalization protests that I'd experienced in the U.S. from the late 90s till around 2011, just before Occupy, but were kind of familiar in a way to Occupy. What I noticed in this COP summit was a very different ethic around what it means to be in critical opposition and critical awareness to a state. There was there was a much more ethical engagement with how we as protesters relate to one another and the brutality of what it is to be engaged in such a, going up against such a large power. And so temperature was strangely toned down, while the anger was so much more palpable. There was an ethical appreciation of holy fuck. Sorry about that. And also a much more considered focus around activist care, and also just care in general, and that was quite interesting, I thought.
Well, because yeah, the reports I'm getting is that they're just going through the motions there and not really doing anything. And then now, but something that people showed their anger and up the game and made them start making some commitments. So that's the point I'm trying to make is don't we have to make. Don't we have to, like, for instance, don't we have to do some disruption? Like, I was at Cancun, the WTO in Cancun, and I was at the battle in Seattle up here, on the outskirts of the battle in Seattle. And we had to, in Cancun, someone brought a banana, snuck a banana tree into the conference and did things like that to disrupt the conference. Do we have to up the game, in Glasgow?
Definitely, there was not so much militant direct action. That was clear. Which is surprising considering Extinction Rebellion's direct action that they've been able to do elsewhere, in London, for example. Definitely...
Well,
sad. Nevertheless, I'm looking at some of the graphics that Extinction Rebellion produced. Post-hope, post-doom, a brown thing, shaped like a pyramid, so post-doom. I think there's a general sense, unfortunately, of the fact that our climate will change radically, and that capitalism and governments are collaborating with capitalist classes will generally profit under any term, and that instead we as people need to develop a deeper and richer culture from below to resist and to organize something far different in a world that would be far different. And so I appreciate what you're saying greatly. It was interesting that the thing that stood out for me was this alternative ethic. Before I went to Glasgow, I was in Amsterdam for a criminal trial of environmental criminals that was put on by the artist Jonas Stahl. It was called the Intergenerational Climate Court, which was a four-day-long trial of ING Bank, Airbus, a variety, and the Dutch state, because it was based in the Netherlands. There were a variety of long trials that were brought witnesses from Brazil, from Cameroon, from around the world to tirelessly, present the criminal case and the criminal negligence of governance and capitalism in the guise, not even in the guise, that's the wrong word, presenting a public trial, presenting the public anger, presenting the total failure of our governing systems to actually penalize these people who are in government and destroying our world. The formal nature of this event was comfortable, but quite legalistic. One thing that it revealed to me in relationship to the protest was the total failure of governance to actually do and have a capacity to, and the talons upon the power to actually do the right thing. At the core of this criminal trial was the conceptual and legal failure of the human rights framework, which, although I haven't done the research, and it's good that we're talking about this, you have to write about this, probably relates to the UN framework to govern these questions around how the hell are we going to stop this mess. My long and labored point is that it seems as though what COP and the current global framework for global governance fails us. And so stuff like this intergenerational climate court that this artist Jonas Stahl puts on seems like a very good kind of effort to produce an alternative governance form. And so while the protests at Glasgow were affective, emotional, angry, in a way, you're barking at a dog that cannot be a cat. We're angry at a bear that can't be a river when we need a river. And so what was interesting for me about this travel was efforts like what this Intergenerational Climate Court, a People's Court, were putting on as an attempt to establish counter politics and counter orders to the day. And so for me, the effective nature of the protest at Glasgow, the questions around who are we and how are we together in opposition to state were also another kind of counterpower, which is also in some ways what I'm seeing in the Zod, which is like, no, we're not. They were very clear that this is not a protest about climate. Their occupation around climate change. It was against the airport and its world. And the distinction is that if you're about climate change, you're talking about the question of global governance. When you're protesting that and you're expecting a solution from above. But when you're protesting this airport, it's very concrete and grounded. But when you're bringing and its world, it's bringing a systemicity and those larger questions, but it's entangled through and it's ridden through this particular place. And if you're able to stop this particular place from being taken over by the airport's world, then you stop the airport's world from expanding while also limiting your own horizons to what that world demands from you.
All right. Well, it sounds like you're saying to do things from the bottom up rather than the top down.
Yes. And right. That perhaps... Can I add one more thing?
Yeah, please.
I was listening to a very interesting interview by Andreas Mann and Fabio Miller online. And it goes back to the question of the WTO protest. Andreas Malm wrote a very good book, How to Blow Up a Pipeline. I think he's a Trotskyist climate activist, but also is a heavy academic. Tadzio Miller is a direct action organizer who started out in academia, became a climate organizer for German NGOs, and became extremely frustrated by the whole thing and is now working as a sex worker and like, ugh, we're screwed. I just want to get screwed. Nevertheless, in the conversation that they had, there was this amazing little bit that I think Fabio Miller was talking about. He was talking about generations of activism. Like you and me, I was also at WTO in Seattle. He came of age at that point where from the transition of DIY culture into internet culture into a global awareness of how the world is changing through the internet, through a global sensibility of a post-Soviet moment. And his narrative was around questions around reclaim the streets, around joys of carnival against capitalism, stuff that we all, you and I and others, really worked on to make the Seattle generation something culturally alive, something that in a way was reborn and re-occupied, minor differences, bringing it to the local in a new way. But the same narrative. What Tadzio Miller pointed out in this conversation with Andreas Malm was that we are now dealing with a new generation of people. Fridays for Future is a youth movement. It's a youth, and the Sunrise movement in the States, it's a youth movement. He made this point about thinking about what is their horizon? What is their activist narrative? And he asked, how do they imagine their activism? And suggested that it will be, in a few years, anchored to something entirely different than the narrative that we narrated through our activism as a generation. I thought that was quite an interesting point, that the stories, when you're talking about, you summarize what I said, going back to the local, we had the thing, I think, in the Seattle era, but we didn't know how to exactly enact that because obviously we were talking about globalization and global governance in a very particular way. And I don't think we really spent a lot of time thinking. I mean, just to be the lamest example of party politics in the U.S., the Republicans run the boards often in local elections across many places in the U.S., control state houses. Democrats are only really effective at a national level. Not to say that we should be thinking about that, but that does point to a critical failure of a left movement to understand how do we actually articulate and relate to the local in a wildly political, wildly community-based, wildly entangled, to use a word from this book, way that is also very much aware of the fragility of the heart, body, and breath that this climate moment brings to us. How do we embody that in our place? And you see that in stuff like decolonial theory, decolonial practice, and I'd even point to the goings-on related to the George Floyd protest and the efforts to defund police, which is to re-network relations between the individual and the state and the community that we never imagined, and that would have quite, to use the language of climate, would have a quite powerful effect in affecting resilience in communities that we will need in the future.
Well, yeah, we have here in Eugene, I'm really impressed with what the young people are doing here. We have the Neighborhood Anarchist Collective. And what they're doing is just getting out in the streets and literally just going down and helping the homeless and networking and just doing the work. And we have Mutual Aid Network here. Those are popping up all over the country, too, these mutual aid networks. My only concern is that I'm wondering if the oligarchs will just stop giving aid completely and just figure, well, you guys seem to be doing such a great job. In other words, that we're enabling them. I'm worried that it just occurred to me the other day that what may happen is that we're enabling them by helping people instead of forcing them to kick down the money and help these people, that we're helping them ourselves, that it's enabling them. And this is something that John Zerzan, we have a local anarchist, John Zerzan, talks about, is that that's why he's against socialism, is because you're enabling them, you're prolonging the inevitable by doing social welfare. But no, I'm really impressed with what young people are doing.
There's a historical parallel that comes to mind. In Spain, under Franco, there were two trends. There was a church, which was running in parallel with, through Opus Dei, heavily influenced those fascist state power. And they strangely organized networks of mutual aid through patriarchal systems that were essentially patriarchal mutual aid networks that were in line with and organized through non-state fascist state actors. Parallel to that was horizontal PNT and other anarchist mutual aid network that answered an entirely different job. And so it's interesting to me. That tension is quite a rich tension that you're talking about between, are we serving the state's needs or are we serving our own needs towards building counterpower? And I don't think that it is so much about the mutual aid itself, because we live lives in sociality with one another, and when we can enrich our community, we are actually building power. The question is not, from my perspective, to be afraid of having power. It's afraid of who the power is serving. Is it serving our communities in an open way that is generating mutual aid and further supporting multitudinous, open, cosmopolitical ways of being, or are we serving daddy?
Right. Right. We have a neighborhood here, the Whitaker neighborhood here, is everyone is getting with their neighbors. And what they're saying is eventually they won't need the police to come in. We just won't even need the police anymore because we will resolve it ourselves. So the police just have no role in that community anymore because they've gotten with their neighbors.
What's wrong with that?
Nothing. That's where I'm hoping that is the example. The other example that I have is that I thought of is during Hurricane Sandy, the powers that be helped the status quo. They helped corporations and the wealthy first. And what happened during Hurricane Sandy, the story that I heard was people needed their houses pumped out of mud. So a lady went and found a pump truck and just started driving around to the houses and pumping them out. And this is where I don't know what you would call that. Is there a name for that where she just found a something that was needed and fulfilled a need herself?
Yeah.
Rather than relying on the government or any hierarchy.
Yeah, and history of, we did a book, I'm trying to remember the name of it. It was a catalog from the Museum of Reclaimed and Urban Spaces in New York. It documented the squatter scenes. Which documented the squatter scene of New York City's ongoing engagement and their utilization of social practices and social skills of squatters and anarchists to deliver mutual aid through Hurricane Sandy. One thing that this talks about and that activist theorists also talk about, we published an article by Not an Alternative that talks about this as well. It's McKee Strike Art about this. That through organizing this counter power that developed from Occupy through Hurricane Sandy, there was, by this point, New York City had developed few lines of communication and network. I'm throwing a lot of words out of here. What I'm trying to get to is a very simple thing, that one thing that was established out of this moment, it seems like, was a collective decolonize this, which was looking at something that seems so very removed from mutual aid. They were looking at statues in major museums. People who were involved in Hurricane Sandy and before that Occupy started doing this institutional critique of power, looking at how power is presented in New York City in the art world, something incredibly abstract. And they started protesting that. One thing that they also did along the same time as protesting that was organizing kids, black and brown, minority background kids, to go to those protests. So they're like, you're not represented here. And along the way to those protests, they realized that on the subway, these people are being heavily policed. And so they started also doing anti-police work. They were probably doing anti-police work all along. And the long and short of the story that I'm getting at is that the Decolonize This campaign was blossomed into a variety of protest forms that really took up speed into the George Floyd protests and the defunding the police movement, all based on mutual aid practices that first began in the narrative that I'm telling, though I'm sure other people would tell it in a variety of different ways. The mutual aid strategies and the critical appreciation of the world in which we're protesting and occupying that was established at first Occupy and then the mutual aid practices in Hurricane Sandy. And so if we... And my point is there's strange bedfellows in histories that we can tell, and that that as important as anything else is an engagement with our neighbors to see where the hot fresh threads of mutual-aided solidarity appear.
Well, yeah, during the WTO, the labor marched with environmentalists, and I noticed the food banks here, a lot of them are religious food banks, but they and the anarchist food banks too, all are welcome, you know, food not bombs too. Everyone is welcome at the, no matter what your political persuasion, all are welcome. All right, but so I hope I've let you finish your point, but
yeah,
you know, what I'd like to see is I'd like to see a sit-ins. Like people, for another example of solidarity, is I like to see customers of Walmart or the townspeople of Eugene or whatever city. And I'm not allowed to advocate. This is just an example, but to have a sit-in, just people walk into Walmart and just sit down until they and block the aisles until they start paying their workers more money or whatever, or stop buying stuff from. Shipping stuff in from foreign lands or whatever, but especially labor. What about sit-ins? What do you think of sit-ins?
I think sit-ins are great. Right on.
So, well, because that's what I thought the journal, I thought what Nature Defending Itself and what a lot of what your, what Journal of Anarchist, Journal of Aesthetics and Protest is about is taking action, is examples of action, nonviolent action.
Yes, definitely. There's a strange thing, though. We've been publishing for 20 years, and there was a point when in our publishing work around 2013 where I realized that there's other people with more money, and I mean this in a good way, and more funding and more critical reach, to be able to catalog a variety of activist tactics and their relationship to aesthetic strategy. There is this book published by Orr Press called Beautiful Struggle that I opened it up, and I was like, oh, we as a journal cannot do any more work in this that is so useful. They have done it. I do not need to do it as a co-editor any more expansion of protest techniques because I don't have my hands on the buttons so much, and I don't have the money on producing stuff of this quality and this newsworthiness. But one thing that I found that we as a Journal of Aesthetics and Protest can do is to think about the no's and the yes's that we as activists, organizers, and political activists and people who love creative life and the beauty of it put in relationship to each other. And so one thing, and that capitalism also puts before us, where we inhabit a world of yes and no rather than realizing the common nature of our reality, that capitalism expects us to exploit our lives towards meaningful ends that can only be ultimately accounted by success and failure. So I'm coming to a point back in a way to how we occupy as a community and how we hold on to those hot points of churches organizing and labor and green people organizing together. Those boundaries are artificial that we place between each other when we think about a social ecology of a city or a social ecology of a country. We need, as loving political leftist people, to figure out how to collaborate better rather than saying yes or no to this or that identity. We need to build better bonds between the conflicts that we have. We need to learn how to work together in difference much more. We need to work together in conflict much more. And there's, just to bring this to a creative project that I'm working on, I've been working on a project about dreaming through conflict together, based on a conflict resolution strategy that I have proposed in a collective that I'm involved with for a left garden and a left garden network in Berlin that has been almost destroyed by conflict. We realize that we've forgotten how we live together and how totally informative both capitalism is in dividing us, but then also organizing our collectivity. And if we could take over the collectivity that we are forced into by the modes that we have to relate to one another as humans, as people in creative projects, as people who work, but also people who are drawn to a project and who make this beautiful thing spring from the ground, we make conflict. And so we propose this project of dreaming together and sleeping together in common. I'm going from a very concrete political conversation earlier to something that's much more abstract and much more dreamy, but I think this would be useful as a vision. We talk about a composition of a city. We talk about Walmart. We talk about these labor relations, and we talk about conflictual relations, and we talk about how to strategize and what is a good strategy or a bad strategy. If we are all peers living together in struggle against oppressive capitalism in a city, in a left city, why is it that we do not organize more holistically together, and why can't we take mutual aid power from below? And so this dreaming project asks the question of, when we go to bed at night alone or with our partner, we are sleeping alone. But then if we're a partner, we're sleeping together. But if we lift the wall between our house and our house, we're now sleeping with our neighbor. And if we lift all those walls in our city, we're all sleeping and dreaming together. And so I ask, what is it, how is the information in our dream time and how we're informing our mind different from the information that we take in as media and relations in the daytime? And I would think that if we could think about dreamtime relations as also active daytime, we might be able to think a little bit more and more critically about how we could work through conflict and disagreement, and also think differently about strategy sessions and relating to one another on the left differently. That rather than thinking about potential allies, potential people who we think have bad strategy, we can understand them as a social ecology that is informative of a way of being together that might evolve in the future. I've kind of into trippy mode, so I'm going to be quiet for a moment.
No, that's great. It just reminds me of the tree sit. There's always a conflict between the vegans and the ovo-lacto vegetarians or whatever, you know, that we all want the same thing. And so it's better to join and put aside your differences and move towards a common enemy. I'm trying to tell people that it's corporations, that we all can agree that we're against corporations. And I don't see, and there's still people that are holding out that think that corporations are an efficient way of running things. But I'm looking for a common.
Because it orders us.
Say again?
We need to figure out ways of, capitalism works because it is an accounting system. It has a system of profits and losses, and that we could suffer by its profits and losses. We as people on the left need to figure out another accounting system. And socialism and communism are ways in which we play with capitalism in its formal senses to come up with something better. But what I'm proposing and what projects like the Zod propose is that we need a more holistic way and ecological way of accounting for relations or accounting for differences.
All right, Mark.
And so you're,
I got to end this. So Mark from Journal of Aesthetics and Protest, calling from Germany, talking to me from Germany and having just been to Glasgow. Thank you very much for your time.
And pushing the book, We Are Nature Defending Itself, co-published by Journal of Aesthetics and Protest and Pluto Press Vagabond Series.
All right, thanks very much.
Dave Jordan and Issa from Mo. Thank you for the plug at the end. Thanks for the conversation. I enjoyed it.
All right, thank you. Bye. Good luck to you.